I'm not pulling in my driveway. We all know what that means. It's time for another Drive to Work at Home Edition. So today we're talking Assassin's Creed, and I have the lead designer, Corey Bowen, with us to talk all about it. Hey, Corey.
Hey, Mark. How's it going?
Okay, so let's go back to the very beginning. You were told you were going to lead the design for Assassin's Creed. What is the first thing you did?
Oh, man, Assassin's Creed. The first thing I did was look up how many games came out since I had last played in my childhood, essentially. I last played around Assassin's Creed Brotherhood, which I believe was near the original trilogy. And then since then, so many games have came out. And there was so much more content to like devour and learn and absorb.
So did you play a lot of Assassin's Creed in preparation?
I did. I got like 4 to 6. I forgot how many. I got a bunch of different titles from different eras to play a little bit of. I think the games are, they're so expansive and so big that I didn't finish all of them. I more like I started each of them to explore what was felt new, what was fresh, what the core of the mechanics were essentially. Played them for a few hours each and then started doing other research as well after I felt like I could take away what I thought the main feel of the games were.
Okay, so when you and I have talked about this, and you broke down the design into three qualities that you thought were the essential qualities of Assassin's Creed. So the three things you said, that Assassin's Creed are about assassins, about history, and about movement or parkour. So we're going to talk about each of the three of them today. So let's start with assassins, because other than Creed, what is Assassin's Creed about?
Yeah, I mean, Assassin's Creed at its core is you play as assassins throughout moments in time, and you're doing a lot of stealth action gameplay. You're taking people out in a stealthy way or in a front way, whatever style you want. But in every game, you're playing as a different character who is part of this secret order of assassins against a different secret order often. So, hey, the game's about assassinating, it's about assassinations. We have assassins in magic, so we know what we think they do in magic, typically destroying creatures. Yeah, I guess that's where we're headed.
Okay, so you knew you wanted to capture assassins. So, right, the first thing you looked at was assassin typal. So how did you approach assassin typal?
Yeah, I mean, it's tricky. So when I got the file handed to me, there was a little bit of like a pre-vision work where there was a small team that worked on a small sprint to explore what colors things could be and if it could match up to a set well. And it was so interesting. They said, okay, this is Assassin's Creed. The assassins are red-black protagonists, and the antagonists will be the Templars, which are like a blue-white antagonist. And so the first thing that I sat down with is looking at all these assassins and thinking about assassin typal and thinking about what colors they would go into and trying to figure out where the different spread of protagonists and main characters would go towards and would they funnel in red black or not. I think I ended up mostly like some of your like assassins, your assassins that really care about assassins will be in the Mardu colors. I do have a red black card that does very straightforward, like give your assassins +2/+0. So there is a, you know, yes, red, black, that's the assassin. There's also blue, black cards that care for assassins matter. There's a whole mechanic that cares a little bit about assassins. There's a Mardu legend that cares about assassins matter. But more than that, there are legends in all colors and a bunch of multicolor legends that are assassins. So not everything is assassins matter, but certainly the red, black stuff leans that way a lot.
Okay. So, I mean, the one thing, whenever you're playing in typo, you have to look at historically what it is, and assassins are pretty heavy black, right? There's not a lot of assassins historically that are outside of black.
Oh, no, there's very, very few assassins in Magic the Gathering that aren't black, and the ones, like, there's some red ones, there really are, but they're, like, memes, almost, or they're just very goofy cards with loose mechanical relevance. Even that, the black assassins are like Royal Assassin, which is a card that taps to destroy a tapped creature. There's just a bunch of assassins that are disconnected, destroying stuff. They don't have synergy with each other in current Magic. So this was more fabricating an assassin strategy for a larger format like Commander, almost, for the cards that we do have to care about assassins. And there was also a point where I was quite happy to see Outlaws of Thunder Junction, one of the sets in the same year, create their mechanic, the Outlaw mechanic, which is a batching of several types, including assassins. So they would generate some Assassin's Matter cards as a collateral and make some assassins along the way. And in addition to that, when Murders of Markov Manor, hold on, is it Karlov? Sorry. Murders of Karlov Manor was set on Ravnica, and there was a bunch of detectives and killings going on. So I knew they would have a little of assassin. And actually, towards the end of that design team, towards the end of that design sprints, I had put in some notes to try to get some of their cards turned into assassins because I wanted a little bit more back support for Assassin's Creed.
Oh, another thing that happened is the disguise and cloak mechanic showed up in, and then you put that on a couple assassins. I think there's three disguise cards and one cloak card, I think.
Oh yeah, totally. Like MKM was using, you know, this pseudomorph mechanic. And at the time it was called cloak and book cloak instead of disguise and cloak. But in general, it felt really resonant with what you're doing a lot in the game, because the game isn't just about not being hidden or not being seen, but a lot of the way that you maneuver through crowds is like you're walking amongst the crowd and you're hiding in plain sight. And then maybe you suddenly, you know, reveal yourself and kill a guy. So there was a little bit of flavor synergy in borrowing disguise for Assassin's Creed to make a little bit of assassins feel more resonant in that way.
Oh, another thing for the audience, just so they understand, we have to make sets that are other people's properties, like UB sets. We have a larger time to make them because we have to loop in our partner and stuff. So even though Assassin's Creed is coming out after Murders of Karlov Manor and Outlaws of Thunder Junction, I believe you designed it actually before both of those were even, like, you finished, pseudo-finished, before they, you know, you were ahead of them, essentially.
Yeah, whenever we do Universes Beyond, our pipelines are different, mostly because the art is very different, just that whole behind-the-scenes process is very different. I don't remember exactly, but I do remember being fairly furnished up on ACR when I was looking at MKM and saying, hey, you know what? This could be an assassin. You should make this one an assassin, please. It would help me out.
Okay, so we talked assassins. Let's go to part two, history. So one of the core things of the game is, well, talk about why history is so important.
Yeah, so in every game, kind of the conceit of the game is that you're using some sort of mod, like you are actually playing as a character in the modern day who is using a piece of technology to revisit the memories of assassins. So when you're playing as an assassin, you're actually playing as a character who is reliving the memories of an assassin and kind of touring that old historical world. And every game has a different historical setting, whether it be Renaissance Italy or colonial America, or like a Greco-Roman and Greece kind of adventure, or an Egyptian adventure. They all kind of tour these different historical areas. And what you'll find is a lot of the Assassin's Creed fan base, even if you don't like the assassins or don't like the through line narrative throughout the games, there's so much love and focus on this like enjoyment of playing in these historically recreated areas. It's like I'm using Greece as a playground. Renaissance Italy is my playground. I'm running around it. I'm hiding among it. I'm within the people. This is the architecture I want to see that reminds me of that kind of historical era. So history is such a huge theme in the narrative. But also, if you don't care about the narrative at all, it is such a draw to so many players. I believe there are some games that even have certain modes or DLC that just lets you explore the area. There's no combat, no fights or whatever. It's almost like a museum mode. Mm-hmm. I believe that is true. I could be wrong. So please don't hurt me, internet. But regardless, history is huge. History is a huge, huge factor in this game for so many reasons. And Ubisoft really tries hard to make sure they approach history respectfully from their end and get it correct. Even though, you know, they're going to interpret stuff differently. It's not like these assassins really existed. But from talking to them, they do try.
So the interesting thing to me is that trying to solve the problem. You hit about something we had to solve in a different problem. Mm-hmm. When we made Dominaria, one of our challenges of doing Dominaria, the set Dominaria, was Magic, like, Dominaria did the setting for Magic for, like, 10 years, so there were, like, 40 sets or something that were set on Dominaria. But in the new era, like, we like planes to have a feel, like, it's about something. And so we were trying to figure out what is Dominaria about, and we decided it was about history, just because so much stuff had happened there, both mm-hmm. within the world and in Magic. So it's interesting that made use of some of our tools of solving history. So
yeah, what's actually kind of interesting about using the historic mechanic and borrowing from Dominaria is that when I joined as an intern in the summer of 2017, like my first project was working on the Dominaria Planeswalker decks, which are like our intro new player starter decks. So almost my first taste of even working within Magic was designing new players using the historic mechanic in the blue and white Teferi deck, which wanted a little bit of historic emphasis. There's this kind of a fun idea of like, oh, borrow from, you know, my first experience ever working on Magic. I'll take that. And I'll bring historic in. Separate from that, historic also works really well for this kind of Universes Beyond product and this universe specifically, where I'm going to make a bunch of, you know, assassin protagonists. They're going to be legendary creatures. I'm going to make a bunch of tools and weapons and mythical artifacts that you're hunting for in the games. And those are going to be artifacts. And I'm going to make a cycle of sagas that represent story moments from this rich universe. And those, you know, they're stories, they're sagas. And so very naturally, we're going to have a lot of stuff within the historic batch already. So it was felt really, really lucky to say, hey, this is the perfect word for this universe, historic, the feeling of history. And it just so happens to be that like 80% of the set is historic.
Yeah, that works out well. So is there anything you did that was any tweaks on historic? Did you do anything that was sort of new?
I don't know if we went very new in terms of tweaking historic. I think it's a little hard to tweak a batching mechanic.
It is tricky.
You could like make a mechanic that refers to historic stuff, but then you can get like reminder text within reminder text issues, which I like to avoid. I thought the most important thing to me about historic was getting history represented on cards in a very straightforward way. So using the historic word made me really happy. And I think there's a lot of really cool cards that reference historic. So I'm quite happy.
So let's talk about one of the most controversial things that you did in design mm-hmm. is you made card of actual historical figures. Let's talk about that.
Yes. Oh, that's a great point, Mark. Yeah, it was so interesting. You know, at the time, you know, Doctor Who Commander was being worked on and Fallout Commander was being worked on. And ACR Assassin's Creed was asking this question of, hey, you know, Leonardo da Vinci is quite a big character in the trilogy, the original NCS trilogy. Oh, hey, you know, like in Black Flag, you're playing with all of these pirates. In Origins, the Egyptian one, you know, you're meeting Cleopatra. Should we make these cards? Is that ethical? Is that weird for Magic? Do we make cards that reference real world historic characters? And me and my creative lead, Lauren Bond, we were working on this, and she kind of took the charge of on the creative side, you know, discussing, should we do this? Is there a safe way to do this? Is there pitfalls? Is there problems? You know, do we want to be depicting historical figures that we don't think were so well regarded in history, for example, or maybe have, you know, committed actions that we don't really want to represent on a Magic card. So we ended up choosing a few characters we really enjoy. We have Leonardo da Vinci. I mean, basically, I mentioned a bunch of them. Leonardo da Vinci, it's really cool. It's a great character. We have a Cleopatra card. It's a great card. We have a Socrates card, the Greek philosopher Socrates. That one's quite cool. And then there's, for the pirates, we have a combo card of Mary Read and Anne Bonny, which were two real-life women pirates who appear in Black Flag, and they appear as a duo in one card here. And then we have a serialized version of these cards where they're in their native tongue. So Leonardo da Vinci is in Italian. Socrates is in Greek. Mary Read and Anne Bonny are still in English, but it's still serialized. And then Cleopatra, which you would think is in Egyptian, but if you know Cleopatra, you know that it is in Greek, her native tongue. And the flavor text is Egyptian hieroglyphics to reference her rule of the Ptolemaic Empire, which I just love. The hieroglyphics make me laugh so much. I thought that we would just not be able to do them at all. And getting them on the flavor text made me so excited.
Yeah, one of the things that I find interesting behind the scenes is, I mean, I think of all the things for the set, this is the one that probably caused the most like discussion within R&D.
Yeah, it was curious. I mean, and I referenced Doctor Who and Fallout because I think those are franchises that play a little bit with history as well. So it was all relevant to everyone on what kind of things we're showing. But I think once we pulled the trigger with ACR, we ended up being really happy with their execution.
Yeah, Doctor Who shows historical figures on cards, but doesn't make historical figures creatures. There's no legendary creatures that are historical figures. I was a fan of it. I mean, I think we drew some lines. I think all these characters are in the ancient past and right, mostly characters that people generally like, you know. So anyway, okay, that is history. Now let's get to the third component that we just don't talk about enough in Magic. Parkour/movement. So why is that important?
Yeah, I mean, and this goes towards why I think playing, refreshing my memory on playing these games was so important. Like I can read a million wiki pages on the lore of these characters, but when you sit down and you play a lot of these games, especially in the earlier games, you'll notice how much of the core experience of this stealth action adventure RPG is moving around, parkouring off of walls, up ceilings, past roofs, between alleys, evading guards, just hiring mercenaries to distract. There's so much movement and evasion and exploration, especially within these games, and that I believe is like, a huge reason why the franchise took off to begin with. And I knew it was really important to capture that. And it's such a difference in making a video game-based universe of Beyond set where you really have to step back and think about what is the core gameplay of the game and how are we expressing that. So I knew I needed something that felt like you were moving or kind of represented movement in a sense that was apart from just like, oh, hey, every card in the set has an evasive ability. Like, is that going to cut it or should we try something else? And I also really needed a good, flavorful kind of thing to do on instants and sorceries. What were the instants and sorceries in the set representing? Are they all going to be murdering or, what are we representing? So we came up with a free running mechanic, which is borrowing a little bit of technology from Prowl back in kind of the Lorwyn Shadowmoor-ish block. Well, I don't remember which one.
If you want, Morningtide, I made Prowl. So maybe we can talk a little bit about that. I did do Prowl. So we can talk about the design of Prowl and then we can segue into the design of free running.
Please.
So the shtick at the time, Lorwyn was a typo set. Lorwyn cared about like species, and then Morningtide cared about classes, right? Mm-hmm. And so we were trying to make mechanics out of classes, and Prowl was my solution to what do rogues do? And so I'm like, well, they're sneaky. And so basically Prowl says that you get a reduction if you've hit them with a rogue. Well, the way Prowl worked is if the creature that has this ability, every creature that had it was a rogue, but some of them were other creature types too. So, but anyway, it basically said, I care about you hitting things because that's what rogues do. But that's where Prowl came from. So how did we adapt it? How did free running?
Yeah. And for what it's worth, as a Magic fan, I have always and do still love rogues. I've always loved rogue mechanics and synergies. So I've always been a fan of Prowl in that sense. And when we even made the Zendikar Rising Commander decks, I like made a new Prowl card because I really enjoyed Prowl. I was like, I want to make Prowl stuff. That being said, in Assassin's Creed, Prowl to me felt like if my creature is going from my battlefield and it is moving past all of your creatures and it is hitting you, to me, that was the magic equivalent of movements. and you know, evasion in a sense is my creature is attacking and is getting to you and rewarding you for that. Feels like I am flourishing my movements. If I have a prowl spell that's like backflip, for example, or free running slash prowl spell, I'm just using an example of the type of mechanic. Like if I had a card that's like called backflip, and it's like, oh, if I hit you, it's cheaper because that means I'm in movement. Like that kind of feels like maybe I'm jumping off and doing a backflip. There's no card called backflip. So sorry, everyone. I'm just joking. But there is a bunch of free running spells that represent these actions you're doing in movement. You know, you can, while parkouring, moving around, you can distract guards with a certain spell, or you can evade suspicions, or you can some petty theft. Yeah, or you can escape detection. There's all these little things that represents more game actions expressed through free running, which is very interesting. And I like that a lot. There's also this one card, it's like Viewpoint Synchronization. It's a green free running card, and it captures this moment that you do in a lot of the Assassin's Creed games where you climb a tall tower and you interact with the vista, and it shows you this huge view of the surrounding area. And that's actually like the mechanism to add that area to your mini map. So as you explore, you want to climb these vistas and then do these huge viewings, which I thought was a very unique thing that felt like a free running payoff made sense for. The other thing about free running is, I guess I didn't fully explain what it is. It's an alternate cost, a lot like Prowl, for instance, or for any spell, but it's most kind of sorceries in the set. So the alternate cost for spells where you can pay the free running cost to cast the spell if an assassin or your commander dealt combat damage to your opponent this turn. So if my assassin connects or my commander connects, I can cast a spell for an often cheaper cost. And they're talking a lot about how assassins matter. We also mentioned earlier how there's not that many historical assassins or assassin synergies in Magic the Gathering, which is, you know, leans towards why we've added Orc Commander there. Orc Commander does two things. One, it broadens these cards' gameplay to not be so siloed within just assassin stuff matters. You know, we talked about what if it's legendary, what if it's this, what if it's that. But really, we're interested in how to broaden this card's for larger formats like Commander. And we think designing a little bit more towards Commander was a positive thing. There's also this idea that incentivizing Commanders to get into combat more often was a fun thing to do in Commander, which is often a slower or more dirtily game. So incentivizing combat in Commander was great. Also, we felt that Commanders, in a sense, in that format, feel like your main character. In Assassin's Creed, your main character is assassin, and you're moving around. You're doing this parkour, and so in Commander, your main character is your commander. And so it felt cool to justify your main character, your commander, doing acrobatic movements in a sense. So that's free running.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. Okay, so I want to talk about something that you mentioned. I just want to sort of get a larger sort of discussion. This is, so there's different kinds of universes beyond sets. Yeah. Some Universes Beyond sets are based on a more narrative thing, right? That it's a story, like, you know. But when you base it on a game, especially a video game, that there is a lot of how you experience a video game is very different than how you experience a book or a movie or a TV show. And it's a lot more, like, most of those you're more passive, like it's happening and you're watching them. But in a video game, you're not just watching, like you're experiencing it. And so there's this interesting idea of how do we make it such that the playing of Magic mirrors some aspect of the playing of the video game. And that's one of the things I found very fascinating in this is like how much you get to just sort of like make it. Yeah, you're playing a game of Magic, but it's reminiscent of playing a game of Assassin's Creed.
Yeah, and I think the I think the free running stuff is the main way that they're doing that. But you know, when you're casting free running cards, they're referencing kind of actions and text you'll see within the game. You know, oh, there's even a card that's like restart sequence. Let me look this card up. Actually, it's a black free running card that is a zombified.
Yes, I can read it. Restart sequence, 3 and a black sorcery, free running 1 and a black. return target creature card from your graveyard to the battlefield.
Right, so this is a pretty straightforward reanimation spell, but this depicts the part of the game where if you die, you restart from a checkpoint. And in the narrative conceit of the game, where I said you're a modern character within a machine reliving the memories, it's kind of funny. It's almost like a video game within a video game. Within the game, this is like, oh, I'm restarting from my checkpoint. But actually, you know, it's the character within the game restarting from a certain memory points in time. But it feels very resonant towards video games to restart from a checkpoint and have that mean I'm back to life again. My character's back. So there's some of that, of thinking of literal actions and visceral stuff. I like to compare it to Lord of the Rings set as an example of a set that's very focused on a story. It is a storyline. You want to reference the characters, you want to reference the story beats of what's going on. And when we're doing Assassin's Creed, not only is it a bunch of different stories, so we have to kind of get the cream of the crop going on. When I'm reading Lord of the Rings, I'm not performing visceral actions. I'm not dodging stuff. When I'm playing Assassin's Creed, archers that are on rooftops don't matter for the story. But as a player, those archers are pinging me a bunch, and they have such a big impact on my gameplay and not like zero impact on the narrative. Like rooftop archers, but they have such a huge impact in the game that we made a card called like Palazzo Archers or something like that, which is a green card.
Yeah, Palazzo Archers, 2 and a green, 2/3 human archer, reach. Whenever a creature with flying attacks, you or a planeswalker you control, a Palazzo Archer deals damage equal to its power to that creature.
Right, so and this is a card that if you've played a lot of Assassin's Creed, you've been hit by these really annoying archers from afar. But again, they serve no purpose in that narrative structure. If there were just some archers hanging out in LTR, maybe we'd have made them, maybe we wouldn't. It wasn't super important. But when we're borrowing from a video game gameplay, you can think more about what are the experiences of the player that aren't necessarily the experiences of the protagonist in a narrative.
So did you make a list, like, at some point early on to say, here's all the game actions that I want to make sure that we reference?
In my research, I did kind of make a list of stuff that I thought would be important. It's tricky because it is such a large franchise that the gameplay and the systems and the game systems will differ slightly from game to game. So you want to make sure you're picking up stuff that are iconic, that you think people care about, maybe waiting towards the games that were more popular, which is generally the original trilogy and some of the later games. So there's some give and take on trying to have your pulse on, hey, what game mechanics are really representative of the whole series and what game mechanics are kind of just in one sliver of a game. But we did make, obviously we took notes. A lot of the card names for free running cards will reference stuff that happens in many of the games. And there are some cards throughout the set that might also reference certain mechanics or narrative conceits.
Okay, well, we're almost out of time today. So any final thoughts on the making of Assassin's Creed now that your baby's finally going to be come out?
My baby's finally going to come out. I'll say that something we didn't reference. This is our first set that, maybe not the first. This is a set that has no draftable game experience or no draft. It's kind of a standalone set. We approach the set with a big thought of let's experiment with this. If we have a set that's not optimized for draft, how can we optimize it for opening a booster and having a lot of fun and telling a story, being very evocative? So I hope that really translates well. It's a very interesting product. I'm really proud of a lot of the cards. So I hope people enjoy it.
Okay, well, thank you so much for being with us today, Corey, and talking with us.
Thank you so much, Mark. Appreciate it.
But to everybody else, I'm at my desk, so we all know what that means. It means it's the end of my drive to work. So instead of talking magic, it's time for me to be making magic. I'll see you all next time. Bye-bye.